from KUER News in Salt Lake City. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. It's hard not to compare the new documentary In Football We Trust to the film Hoop Dreams. They're both about young men trying to overcome poverty and the influence of gangs, and professional sports is the way out. Hoop Dreams was set in the south side of Chicago. In Football We Trust is set here in Utah. It's about four Polynesian high school football players and how their families, their culture, have the highest expectations for them to make it to the NFL. The film explores how these boys are trying to bear expectations that seem at times almost unbearable. But the film is also the story of immigrants, how the Polynesian culture intersects with the American dream. We're continuing our coverage of the Sundance Film Festival today. We'll be live in Park City talking about In Football We Trust. Join us after the news.
Hi, this is Elaine Clark, one of the producers of Radio West. Our free podcasts are made possible by KUER's generous listeners. If you're a fan, we invite you to put $10 in our tip jar. Text KUER to 85944 to make that donation. Thank you.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. There's a moment in the documentary In Football We Trust that seems kind of breathtaking. The film is about four Polynesian high school football players here in Utah and their dream to play in the NFL. They're gifted, these kids, strong and fast and driven with an intensity that could either make them great or ruin them. They come from big families. They're all living paycheck to paycheck, as someone points out in the film. And everyone realizes professional sports is the way out. The way out of poverty, but also the way out of the gang culture that has come to have such a pervasive influence on the Pacific Islander community in this state. In this scene, one of these kids, Harvey Longhi, talks about the expectations on him. To do better, to go further than his older brother, and then you hear his mom, too.
My older brother messed up, and now he's just another Polynesian trying to catch a job. My mom's just like, your brother's not doing anything good for our family. You're the only chance right now.
I think for the salvation for the Longhi family is Harvey. And all hope right now is for Harvey.
Harvey was 17, maybe 18 at the time. The salvation for the family. Can you imagine the pressure he feels? And that's what the film is about. But it's also about culture and family and faith. Today in the program, we're continuing our coverage of the documentary films at the Sundance Film Festival. We're live on Main Street in Park City here at the Sundance headquarters for the Utah Film Commission, and we're talking about In Football We Trust. Let me introduce the filmmakers. We have with us Tony Vainuku. He directs In Football We Trust. It's his first film. He was born and raised here in Salt Lake City. He's a first-generation Tongan American, and we should say the first Tongan director to be accepted into Sundance. Tony Vainuku, welcome. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Erica Cohn is with us, producer and co-director of the film, also a Utah native. She's directed a number of short films, including Giant Steps, about art in Cambodia. And Erica, welcome to you. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
In Football We Trust is part of the documentary premiere section of the festival. There are still two screenings, and we'll give you the details about that as we go along. And I want to start, Tony, with you. How personal is this film for you?
It's extremely personal. I grew up in the same community and amongst the same culture of our four athletes that we follow for 5 years. I played football since, you know, I was 6 years old. I think my cousins and friends all wanted to play. You know, we all saw ourselves playing in the NFL after seeing players like Junior Seau and Vaisa Kahema, you know. They became hope, you know, for the place we lived in. You know, I grew up very poor and you know, we had not very much to look forward to as far as, you know, there were gangs and there were drug dealers and things like that. But, you know, when you start seeing your culture in the NFL, you know, there's a different role model. So, yeah, it's very personally that way. I had my younger uncle, Joe Katoa, who was our NFL hopeful, was called the next Junior Seau at his time.
Yeah.
He experienced a lot of the pressures that Harvey Longhi experiences His parents, my grandparents, were from the islands, you know, just trying to create opportunity here in America. But his story had took a tragic turn, and he ended up being, he did 10 years in prison and had just got out in time for the premiere. So
wow. It's interesting because it seems like a couple of things are going on in your mind as you're thinking about this film. One is, hey, let me tell the story of these heroes I had when I was a kid and mm-hmm. my cousins had when they were kids. Yeah. Vi, Sekahema, as you mm-hmm. said. Mm-hmm. A lot of them, so that's part of it. But then you're also seeing this story of your Uncle Joe mm-hmm. where he gets almost there. Mm-hmm. So there were two parts to it. And I guess I'm wondering, which story did you want to tell, and did they at some point become both of those things?
They did become both. I mean, that it wasn't until years later that I had an opportunity to make this documentary. Halotingata and Choi Polamalu were showing up, and making. There was a presence of Polynesians in colleges and in the NFL. So it was perfect time for me to tell something that was really dear to my heart and the culture behind the NFL, but because of my uncle's experience, I wanted, you know, not everybody makes it to the NFL. Yes, we do well in the NFL, and the stats are, you know, 28 times more likely to make it in the NFL than any other ethnic group. However, there are a lot of us that don't, you yeah. know, and I wanted to definitely share that story and the culture behind it.
Well, one of the things you've talked about, and we'll get into this as we go along, but as you've talked about how your Uncle Joe, his parents, really never expected him to hold a job. His coaches kind of ignored his academic challenges. I mean, you were paying attention to this kind of stuff. You saw how it turned out, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. I mean, you know, when something happens to someone really close to you, you know, you look for answers. And, you know, and of course he had responsibility in his own decisions. But, you know, the life outside of football, that wasn't, you know, being supported, you know, and I don't totally blame his parents. I mean, they're coming from the islands. They're depending on an education system here in America that they're not totally familiar with. But when, you know, you have seven classes and five of your teachers are coaches,
yeah,
you know, there's an issue there, and so I start looking at. Wait, hold on. This isn't just Joe's fault. Like, there are things that were ignored. He actually had a run-in with where he had smoked marijuana, and he was their star player, and they were going to state, and they suspended him for one game, and he was right back in because it was playoff time, and so.
That's a story that kind of plays out in your film, too. Yeah, is it interesting how parallel some of these stories are to what your uncle experienced and some of these other things, that they all have a kind of a cycle to them almost?
Oh, yeah. I mean, Joe's story becomes a combination of our four boys. Fihi deals with poverty like a lot of us Polynesians do, and just trying to create an opportunity for education. We have the Bloomfields who deal with their last name and gangs. Yeah. And then you have Harvey Lange with that, you know, that God-given talent and what comes along with that, you know, the family pressure, the system. And so, yeah, it couldn't have gone any better. And the story worked out to where we were able to tell a very truthful and impactful and story. And we had 5 years to do it.
Yeah, 5 years. I mean, Eric, I want to bring you in. I mean, so you have, and I actually want to spend a little bit more time with Tony about how your culture related to the way you conducted interviews, talked to people about what the film was about, how you put the film together. But Erica, talk about your role. How did you see your role in the story?
So I was living and working in L.A. When I got a call from Geraldine Dreyfuss, who's the executive producer of this film and really has been a mentor for me. And she said, hey, I think that you should come back to Salt Lake. Do you want to come back home? I was born and raised here. And she said, I have this incredible, charismatic, first-time filmmaker, Tony. I think you would really get along. I think you'd be great partners in this project. And I think this would be a project that you really identify with that, you know, is literally in our own backyard. So I came home and I played sports all through high school. I really understand the highs and lows of competitive athletics. Really felt that sports are, it's a great catalyst to talk about other social issues.
Yeah.
And Tony and I really felt similarly about that and decided to, you know, embark on this. We didn't think it would be a five-year journey, but it ended up being a five-year journey. Yeah. And I think that we really complemented each other putting this together.
You know, it's interesting. One of the things you've talked about, there's a film called Polynesian Power about Pacific Islander culture, and that was made by white filmmakers.
Yeah.
And you've talked a little bit about that. So I'm trying to get a sense of what you think the difference is between a film that explores a culture by outsiders and someone like yourself inside. Like, what's the difference, do you figure?
So we were at a Q&A, and Leva Bloomfield, who's one of our subjects in the film, that question came up. You know, what was it like to... why'd you do the film? And he said... I'm not a camera guy, he said, but if a white guy walked into my room and asked me to put a camera in my face, he says, I would tell him to get out. But it was because of Tony being part of my culture that I trusted that, and I think all the families knew that I had their best interests at heart. And we, you know, there was Polynesian Power, but I think the Polynesian culture especially understands that this is, you know, the first time we've ever really, really been documented in this way.
Yeah.
And, yeah, we just hope that.
But I wonder if that made you feel like, on one hand, all right, like, what's your role? Because you're friends with them. I mean, you have to be. I mean, you have because sure. They know you're part of your culture. But you're also a filmmaker,
right.
And you are trying to get to an essential truth.
Right.
And there are moments in this film that I'm imagining the people in it winced a bit. Language probably, particular stories that they didn't want to reveal, moments that when they said something about their mom that they maybe wouldn't have said if they knew their mom was going to be watching later in an audience. So, I mean, how did you get their trust yet also realize that I've got to stick to a truth because I'm an artist? You know what I mean?
Right. Well, with the advice of Jared Hess, you know, who was a mentor of mine, he said, you know, definitely you need to just point and shoot everything. So since the trust was there,
yeah.
And they knew that they didn't know where this ended. You know, they just knew that I was going to shoot and tell this story. So they just trusted that much. And what I did is shot everything I possibly could as far as story. So there wasn't ever any issue or question with what we needed to shoot. In fact, there is a scene, in my favorite scene, but a tragic scene, where one of our kids goes to jail. And his mom called me that day. I didn't even know what happened. And I was actually on my way to go shoot with Harvey Lange at a game. I'll tell you this story. So Quarter, so awesome. She calls me and she says, Tony, my son just brought a gun to school. He's being taken to DT. You need to come down here and shoot this. She goes, because this is what I want to stop. This is the story. She says this stuff has to stop. She was very, very upset. And I call Erica and I'm like, Erica, what do you want me to shoot? What should I do? I have Leva here and I'm going over to Harvey's. There's a pretty big game. And Erica's, put everything down. Forget Harvey. Get your butt over to Leva, right? And I'm like, torn. I shouldn't have been torn at all. So I rushed down to Leva's situation and... was able to shoot that, and it ends up being, you know, a really, really hard scene to watch. I watched this film over and over, and I watched it again downtown with some of an outreach screening, and still in tears, you know.
Well, it's so interesting because she says to him, like, so much of it is part of pride. She tells him, she says, you know, Leva, I wanted to be able to go to the the ticket counter at the school and proudly say, these are my kids. And now, because he takes this gun to school and, you know, I mean, it really undoes his, at least, right. What, and I don't want to give too much away, actually.
Sure.
But she's heartbroken.
Yeah.
And not only that, I mean, not only does she feel like this is hurting the pride of the family, but she's worried about Leva's brother, mm-hmm. Vida, who you know, they're all in this together, and all of that sense of anguish really comes right at that particular moment, and there you are with a camera. Yeah. It's kind of a gift that you were there, even though it's such a terribly sad scene.
Yeah. Absolutely, yeah. It was tough to be at, and a tough moment that, you know, I think they were scared to relive, you know, when we showed them the film for the first time, but it worked out.
I wonder, Erica, if when you first started, did you see any of these storylines developing? Because you started right in the early days. Everyone has hope and promise at the first.
Yeah.
And clearly you're not going to hope that something goes south, but when do you start seeing the storylines as they start to develop over the years as you're with them?
So when Tony and I really went full-blown into production in the summer of 2010, we decided to cast our net really wide and had explored bringing on a lot of other young, talented men who were going through all kinds of different challenges and having no idea how their stories would turn out. But I think it was that fall, like things just started happening, and all of a sudden we were just, Tony and I had thought we would have a DP with us the entire time and that we would, you know, be really kind of having this big production, but quickly it just became the two of us after a fundraiser where we were only able to raise a couple thousand dollars. So Tony took the camera and just was running, kind of like a chicken with his head cut off, everywhere. Things were happening and totally unexpected. And we quickly found out that the Bloomfields and Fihi Kafusi and Harvey Longhi were going to be our main subjects and stayed true to that vision. It was really hard in the editing room to make sure that we were able to tell all four stories.
Yeah.
But both of us were really committed to making that happen and worked with different editors to ensure that we had all of those stories in.
So the first rough trailer that we put together was based on Joe Katoa. So we had a template of like that was put out first by me and Jared Hess.
Wow.
And that's kind of, everybody was interested, like, wait, what? What's going on here? You know, we have this new immigrant story. And so there's new news pieces of Joe. And so we have this template of a story we want to tell. We get with our subjects, and we were a little bit worried at first because we're shooting with them, and they're all good boys, and they're great, and their families are great. And
But that's not a film.
That's not a film.
Right?
It's not a film. It's like,
yeah.
Where's the conflict, right?
Yeah.
But I knew. Erica and I had a discussion about that, and she was like, you know, Tony, do we need to add more? You know, more, right? And so, and I'm like, no. Me understanding the culture, I said, because we had talked about Joe, like, Joe's story needs to be told, and maybe these kids don't have, you know, that type of story. And I knew with the culture, I was like, no, that's all of these kids are Joe. And very unpredictable. That's just, you know, a lot of us Polynesians are going through these same things. We just need to stick with this. And we were lucky to be able to do it for 5 years to get these moments. We tried. My goal was to, you know, do it in two. But it turned into five, which, you know, that's just me not understanding how long the process really would take.
I want to play a quick scene from this is something Vaisa Kahima, former NFL player, one of your heroes, as you talk about, which gets to this question of how much of a story of immigrants this is, how much of an American story this is, and how they fit in. Early on in the film, there's this scene where Harvey's father talks about how he lives in this white neighborhood, fairly affluent. And he said, you know, when we first moved in, the neighbors didn't know what to make of this big, massive Polynesian family who had, nine kids altogether, plus however many cousins on any given time. I mean, the place was packed from time to time, I'm guessing. And he said that they didn't quite know what to make of it. They were suspicious of it. And I think, did you realize that was going to be a theme in the film, the idea of the conflicting cultures? Because it is, I mean, you do see it as that part of the story too, don't you?
Right, absolutely. I mean, did we want to, you know what? Go ahead, Erica, you can answer that one.
Yeah, I think that was really important to us because there's a very blatant inherent racism, I mean, a factor in this. It was difficult to find a way to tell that. And it wasn't until later in the film that we were really trying to figure out a way to bring that back in. And there's a couple other scenes in the film that we talk about the issue of race. I mean, this is a predominantly white city. What is it like to be a young man of color trying to find a place in a predominantly like affluent white neighborhood? What is it like to experience the culture clash? What is it like to deal with these issues? And I think the clip that you chose is a great example of that. Yeah.
And I want to talk about just one scene that, as far as the race goes, Sita is trying to get all nine kids into a game that her son is the star player to, selling out seats every week. And she asked the principal, I don't have enough money, $5, for all my kids. And he says, okay, no problem. I'll have you guys pick up all the garbage after the high school games in order for your kids to get in. And to me, you know, I made sure.
And that's why people are coming to those games is to see, in part, right. Harvey.
And so I question whether that principal would have ever asked a white family to do that. So that was, I made sure that, you know, that's in there. And I think, you know, it's tough to watch for me personally. And I just hope that people see that scene and understand that for what it is.
Let me play this clip from Vaya Sekahema. In Football We Trust is the film.
One of the things that's part of our DNA and our genetic makeup is that we have a chip on our shoulder. You know, we come from such a small place that nobody knows who we are. It creates this inner drive of wanting to excel and succeed.
What does football mean, Tony, to these families? Why is it so important? I mean, because this is an important part of this story. Why is football so important?
Well, it's, I think, you know, we're physically able to, I mean, Haloti has said that the NFL is really surprised with, you know, how big we are and how fast we are. So physically, you know, we're fit for the game. And Troy Polamalu talks about, you know, our culture just embodying what football is. So there's that. But football is also one of the first industries that has embraced Polynesians, right? And then we have such little media attention. It's either we're in the NFL or there's gangs. So it becomes, you know, you have nine kids and you have, you know, three of them can play football. You naturally are going to want your kids to do what they succeed in. Or do what they have an advantage in, and they support that. And so that's where, you know, a lot of pressure and just...
Let me play another clip. This is Fua Bloomfield. He is Vita and Leva's father. He has his own story, which you tell in the film. And then star Lotulele?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Lotulele.
Lotulele, who plays for the Carolina Panthers. You're going to hear both Fua and Star here, which talks about what football means to some of these families. Here again from the film In Football We Trust.
We're hardworking people. I live paycheck to paycheck. Football, man, it's not a way out, man, it's a way up.
We don't want to see our parents struggle. They brought us from the islands to America to kind of give us more an opportunity, and I think that's what we're doing, is trying to take advantage of it. And football just happens to be the best way for us to do that.
It's interesting. Haloti in the film talks about how there's a lot of pride in the culture. And your family name is bound up in all of this, too?
Yeah, absolutely. Our last name is everything. You know, with when we come from the islands, you know, everybody, all families are known for something historically within their families. Oh, those are talented dancers, or these guys are tough, or, you know, they're just all different types of talents. So yes, our last names are everything. It's important to us to have children that will represent our last names and continue the family name. But with that, you know, you have the Bloomfields yep. that have built, you know, their last name now carries with them the pride to be, you know.
Fighters. Gang members.
Right. And they're very passionate about their family. And if gangs, you know, it's so, it's all meshed in with their family. So they're going to stand by their family regardless. And whether that's called a gang or not, it's their passion for their family that they're protecting.
Yeah.
And their family's legacy.
Right.
It's Erica Cohn, Tony Vinuku also with us. They co-directed the film In Football We Trust. I should say there are waiting lists for the Sundance screenings on Tuesday and Saturday evenings, both at 6 o'clock. You can get all the details on our website, radiowest.kuer.org. We're broadcasting from Main Street in Park City at the Utah Film Commission's living room at the Park City Museum, and we need to take a break. We'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we continue our coverage of the Sundance Film Festival with a powerful documentary centered here in Utah. It's the story of four Polynesian high school football players and their dream to play football in the NFL. If you saw the film Hoop Dreams, it's kind of like that. Gifted young people, some of them trapped in poverty and gangs and looking to professional sports as a way out. But it's also about how Polynesian culture translates here in the U.S. and the extraordinary pressure put on the shoulders of these young kids. The film is called In Football We Trust, and we're here in the Park City Museum. It's the Utah Film Commission's living room is what they're calling it. It's kind of their headquarters here for the festival. We're talking to Tony Vinuku. He directed the film, and the co-director is Erica Cohn. They're here with us as well. I want to talk about another one of the characters. You mentioned him a little bit earlier, but Fihi Kafusi. Just introduce us to this kid. He's great, like all of them are.
Yeah, Fihi Kafusi is an incredibly charismatic, open, honest, passionate young man who decided to be a part of this film really because he wanted to help other kids. There's a couple moments in the film that are really, really difficult to watch where he's so vulnerable and talks about some of his past experiences with his family and what it's like to deal with abuse and how to overcome that and how he's really put his faith in God and how faith has carried him through difficult times. And for him in the film, it's really faith or football, and
right.
trying to find a way for faith and football to intersect. And he says, if I can just handle the church and the football, everything else will
right.
just fall into place.
It's interesting. That's such an interesting element, and we should point this out, that the Mormon culture is another culture that you have to take into account in this story, because not all Pacific Islanders in Utah are Mormon by any stretch, but a lot of them are, and these kids are. They're the ones that, at least that you've chosen, they're connected to the LDS Church. Talk a little bit about that, because that's another twist in the story.
So, yeah, well, Polynesians as a whole are very, very spiritual and a faith-driven culture. In Utah, you know, most of the Polynesians, yeah, of course, not all of them, are LDS,
yeah.
are Mormon. And within Fihi's life, it definitely plays that role and really becomes something that helps him with structure in his life and really helps him actually, you know, stay away from some gangs and a lot of different things. So it's definitely part of the culture.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, when we were talking about this story at the beginning of it, we kept getting reactions. Polynesians in Utah. I don't get it. you know, this is blowing my mind here. And you know, we would explain that the Mormon Church was really instrumental in bringing Tongans and Samoans over to the United States, and specifically Utah, because that's where the church headquarters are. And, you know, we tried to show this culture clash of the islands and the climate versus Salt Lake with tons of snow a few times in the film. And I think, I think that that's a fascinating dynamic. I mean, also...
Our executive producer would tease and said, we should call this movie Polynesians in the Snow. He goes, because it blows me away on why they would ever leave this beautiful island for this snow.
But not only that, I mean, think about... The thing I kept thinking about was the fact that there's no ocean. And that's as critical a part to Polynesian culture as you can get. And you're in a desert, basically. I mean, so you've got all these really weird conflicting... But they're here, I mean, and they're committed to it.
Right.
I wanted to play another clip. This is Fihi Kafusi again. He goes back to live in Tonga for a while. As you'll hear in this clip, he doesn't think much of his father. His father's obviously disappointed him. But you get a sense here, and I wanted to have you talk about this once we play this clip, about how they're motivated by the things that they want, but they also see the examples that they don't want. Here's another clip. This is Fihi Kafusi from the film In Football We Trust.
Staying in Tonga with my dad wasn't all that great. I'll just say it, like, flat out. He's a cheater. A drunk, no respect for him, but yeah. Getting hit and all that stuff, you know, I didn't like it. Seeing him is not, shows me what I don't want to be. And it shows me that I can be something better than that, you know. It gives me more drive to get everything that I need to do for my family, since he's not doing it, to take care of him, do the things that I need to do.
Talk about that, Tony, because you see this in almost all of the stories. They have uncles who have disappointed them. In some cases, their father has disappointed them. It didn't quite go all the way. You yourself, think about it, Uncle Joe.
Right.
So they're motivated by what they want, but they're also motivated by what they don't want to be.
Right. I think that's a little bit universal. You have things that happen to you in your life, and you have two choices. You can either let that spring you forward or let it hold you back. And for Fihi, who is such a... great kid, and I keep calling them kids because we had stole a moment of time with them. And
yeah.
I'm kind of going to get off subject, but we were trying to get them into places, and we were like, wait, are they 21? And they're 21 years old, so it's been so long. But he did use it to spring forward, and all of our kids are, in their own ways, success stories. You know, in some people's eyes, it, there is defeat in there, yeah. But I think for me personally, it definitely triumphs.
Yeah, I would agree. I mean, Fihi's example on the clip that you'd played is just, it's so emotional, it's beautiful, and like we said, he really, to replace his father, put his faith in God, and that kind of pushed him forward, and really, when you talk about legacy, he really wanted to create a legacy for his family.
It's really hearing that, this bite that you just played, you know, without watching it, you know, it's kind of tough. That's a tough part in the movie,
yeah.
As well as with our culture. We don't usually...
get emotional like that?
No, talk about, you know, things like that.
Right. Because that you keep private.
Yeah, definitely. And I think that's a tough thing to watch. In fact, Quarter, the mom of Leva Bloomfield and Vita, had called me, and she says, you know, one thing I'm so proud of is that Fihi talked about his father and the issues that he had, because we're all very, we respect our elders, and whether they're, whatever they're going through, it's taboo to ever share that. So Fihi sharing that shows you who Fihi is. He's courageous and is going to try and change things. That's what he was wanting to do in this film. And so that's tough listening to that,
yeah.
You know, without watching it.
Here's another powerful moment from the film. This is Vita Bloomfield and his father, Fua. They're talking about that same thing, seeing examples in their lives that they're trying to run from, trying to escape that fate, and it gives you a sense of just how crucial football can be. Again, from the film, In Football We Trust.
Being a part of family that's, people say, a gang family, it was really hard for me, and especially Lola, because you see your uncles and cousins come and go. Either they go back to prison, come out of prison, or they pass away, or they leave because they got deported. You don't get used to them being there. Like, you just know that they're there for a little bit.
Man. Have an older brother I haven't seen. Shook his hand. Gave him a hug. For over 10 years now. My little brother, same thing. How did I escape that fate? Man, football.
Wow. Again, one of the, I mean, the way Vita expresses that, you know, they're either deported or, but when he says you don't get used to them being there,
yeah,
it just breaks my heart because I went through the same things growing up. In fact, my own person, my last name, and why a lot of my family is so proud is because my last name actually carries a lot of what the Bloomfield last name carries, a lot of gangs. I have a lot of cousins that are in prison now for, you know, over 10 years, 17 years. I mean, it's an issue. So to hear that, I mean, it's tough.
Yeah.
So
that's Tony Vainuku, director of In Football We Trust. Erica Cohn with us, co-directed and produced the film. There are waiting lists for the Sundance screenings for tomorrow and Saturday evening. Both are at 6 o'clock. You should give it a shot, though. For details, you can go to our website, radiowest.kuer.org. We're going to take another quick break. We'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we are broadcasting from the Utah Film Commission's living room. It's their sort of their headquarters during Sundance here at the Park City Museum on Main Street. We are talking about the film In Football We Trust. We have Tony Vainuku with us, who directed the film, Erica Cohn, who co-directed it and produced it. There are waiting lists for the screenings. We'll give you more details about that as we go along if you want to give it a shot. So I wanted to... one of the things that you begin the film with is this remarkable statistic that you referenced, Tony, a little bit earlier. There are about 240,000 Samoans and Tongans living in the United States, but they are 28 times more likely to play in the National Football League than any other ethnic group. And I guess the question is why? Fua Bloomfield kind of gets into this a little bit in the film. Gets to this idea that it's about intensity, because it's not just about physical gifts. There's something else going on there, and I don't want to verge into stereotypes here,
certainly.
But because I think that is probably a problem that you have to deal with from time to time. That all Samoans are really great at football and they're really big and fast and all those kinds of things. But there is something that's interesting about that. So I want to play a clip here. You'll hear from, I think in this clip, Fua Bloomfield, But also Vita, and I think Leva is, as well, talking about, and Fu was talking about his kids, how one kid, Leva, has that intensity. And he's really honest here, because it must have been hard for Vita to see it in some ways, because he says Vita doesn't really have that intensity necessarily. And it's that intensity that's so interesting. Let me play this clip, another clip from the film In Football We Trust.
My dad, he's crazy. He played, when he was 11 years old, he played with his dad's men's team. My grandpa threw him in. You got to learn somehow.
Supposedly, he's the best running back ever to come through. They got one of his Hunter Wolverine flags right here.
He was one of the best running backs in the country at his time. He didn't make it past the college level due to personal problems. Everyone tells me to go farther than our dad. Just a lot of pressure.
He's done. Just trying to make a name for myself. On the field, man, that ain't nothing nice. Man, what I learned on the streets, mentality, man, I transferred it all on that football field. It's all about mental toughness. And with Vita, you know, it doesn't have that I wanna rip your damn head off mentality. Whereas Leva, I mean, he's totally different. I mean, he's got that chip on his shoulder. He and I are alike. He and I are alike, and that's my boy.
So I think, you know, football was really the first industry that opened up to Pacific Islanders. And like any other new immigrant population, you go with an industry that is more open. And going back to legacy, I mean, it's really, for the Bloomfields, it's like their father didn't make it past the college round. You know, I want to make it to the next level. I want to go beyond what my parents did. I want to make it to the next level. And I think what's so beautiful about this film, you know, the title, In Football We Trust, came from a scene that didn't make it into the film when Tony and I started working with the Bloomfields. You know, there was this one moment during family home evening, which is...
Explain what that is for people who aren't Mormon.
It's a Monday night kind of prayer, you know, family dinner. And, you know, some families do a Sunday night dinner. It's universal, but this is called family home evening. And every... kid went around and said, you know, what's going on in their football season. And really, you know, this is during a prayer, so they were appreciative, you know, to the Heavenly Father for the God-given gifts that they're so fortunate to have. And I think that faith is definitely a part of this, too. So In Football We Trust replaced the In God We Trust for us in this film. But I also think what's so beautiful about In Football We Trust is we go beyond football. I mean, we talk about how football is an industry that Pacific Islanders are excelling at, but our tagline is make your own history. And I think Tony is really making history for the Pacific Islander community and demonstrating that Pacific Islanders can have a role outside of football, in this case, you know, a clothing line and director of the film.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's you were, I think if I have the story right, I read that you, somewhere around your sophomore year, you figured, all right, football's not for me. I'm going to take another path. Was that a hard decision?
You know, I excelled in football. I definitely did well all the way going up to my sophomore year and could have pushed on. But again, I come from similar circumstances where I had to go to work and help my family out. So, and I wanted to have a little bit of money in my pocket, so... I started working during high school, and you know, football became secondary to what was important for me at that time in my life. My parents had went through a divorce also during my sophomore year, so you know, I had to step up in a lot of different ways, and ended up getting myself through college. Was the first kid out of my family to go to a private college out here, Westminster. And so, you know, I just wanted to continue to be an example and create a life that I could that would benefit my family's situation that I can give back.
Did you ever feel like, I mean, because I think this is one of the takeaways from the film, that don't put all your eggs in football. I mean, there's so many more options for us. We can do this.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, that's exactly the point of the whole movie, that it's great. You know, football has been good to us. I'm not saying, not to play it if you're talented and this can provide an opportunity for you, but don't do it at the cost of staying eligible. A lot of our NFL players says, all the colleges cared about was staying eligible. A ton of them have communications degrees. No offense to people that have communications degrees, but they're a little bit easier for these players. And all of them have the same degree. That's not really their interest. It's just what will keep them eligible. And then when they're done with football,
Then what?
Yeah, then what? A lot of these NFL players, business people, they don't want to have anything to do with them after they're done playing. It's like everybody is off that train. And so it's like, and then what? A lot of these NFL players are going broke. And so, yes, use it as a way to get an education. But no, don't use it as your only option.
I think that there's a scene I want to play which is really powerful, because Harvey really expresses this, I think, almost better than anyone. And it's this really intense moment. I think it's a family home evening again. And everyone is – Harvey he's the salvation for the family, as we heard earlier. And he starts to get all these recruiting – people are interested in recruiting him. He gets these offers all over the country. He screws up once. Some of the offers are withdrawn. But he's able to sort of get back on track a little bit, and he has to make a call about which college he's going to go to. And it comes right down to USC or Utah. And so they have, I'm guessing they do all the time. They have a family home evening where they talk about where should Harvey go. Like, it's not Harvey making this call just for himself. Everyone's got to sort of chime in. And this intense scene, I want to play this. Harvey's talking about the fact that, the family's saying, hey, let's go. You should go to Utah because we want you close by. And he's feeling the intensity of the pressure, but also the fact that people only care about him when he was doing well. It kind of gets to your point, Tony, I think.
Right.
And so you'll have to strain, I think, to listen to him. Harvey's obviously really emotional about this time. And as he says, I'm just tired. And he's feeling all of this pressure. Here's another moment from In Football We Trust.
Thanks, everyone, for your guys' opinions. I'm just tired. Because I told myself I'm going to make it one day so I can help all you guys. I promise. And that's a promise I said to myself. And then the stupid thing that happened with the police and stuff, and I got suspended. Everyone hated me. I went to school, no one liked me. But then when I do good in football and all this stuff, they come up like, oh, what's up, Harv? And then right when I leave, they hate me. They talk crap. All my best friends, they talk crap. They just say they're my friend, and so it's just because of my success right now. The world is yours until you just do something stupid.
I don't know if I can handle listening to any of these. When I'm watching the film and seeing this, I'm thinking about camera and stuff, and the angles and stuff. Listening to this is just, this is really emotional.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a tough thing.
The intensity of the pressure on him, and the fact that I'm a good guy when I'm doing well, but as soon as I blow it, or if I make a mistake. I mean, that just adds this another element to the tension and the pressure. It must be extraordinary for these guys. I can't imagine it. And I think, as you said earlier, they're older now, but these guys were trying to figure this stuff out when they're 17, 18 years old, and their minds are still forming, Mm-hmm. I mean, it's really amazing. Mm-hmm. Let me ask you, what was the reaction like, and how nervous were you sharing all of this with these kids and their families? Young men now, I guess, in their families.
So Friday we premiered at the Grand Theater. It was the first screening at the Grand Theater. It was our world premiere. It was the first time our local community had seen this film. We had shown this, our subjects the film prior to the screening, but their families hadn't seen it yet. Mm-hmm. And I personally was incredibly nervous. I was so nervous. It was, you know, this is the Old South High for us. This is a place where I used to audition for plays as a kid. This is, you know, Tony can speak to his own experiences there too. But it felt like Sundance, and it didn't, because this is the community that has supported us for so long.
Right.
This is the community that we have received, so much love and encouragement from. These are the communities that we've filmed with. These are our families. These are our friends. And, I don't think that there'll never be another world premiere moment like that, but it was just, it was so special.
Nerve-wracking, nerve-wracking, definitely. We sold out, and we were the first film to sell out, 1,200 seats within an hour and a half. Bird Running Water, who had announced us that day, he said, "In all my years of working with Sundance, that was the most diverse, the best audience I've ever seen at Sundance." We got two standing ovations. So when they brought us up, before the movie even started, they gave us a standing ovation. Yeah. And I jumped on there and was like, well, let's watch the movie first.
Then decide.
And then decide whether we still get that standing ovation. So we were lucky and fortunate to get two standing ovations. I couldn't be more happy with how it all turned out. So we were excited, and everybody came out to support. Everybody loved it. There wasn't any negative there wasn't any negative feedback.
Well, congratulations, you two.
Thank you.
Thanks very much for being with us. That's Tony Vainuku, who directed In Football We Trust. Erica Cohn co-directed and produced the film. There are two screenings left as part of the Sundance Film Festival, tomorrow and Saturday nights, both at 6 o'clock. I think there are wait lists, but you can give it a shot. Go to our website for the particulars, radiowest.kuer.org. Radio West is a production of KUER News. Our thanks to Sandra Morrison of the Park City Museum. Also thanks to the Utah Film Commission and Virginia Pierce. KUER's engineer is Lewis Downey. The program is directed by Mike Anderson, produced by Benjamin Bombard, Andy Lane Clark, and I'm Doug Fabrizio.